Scripture reading this morning is from Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. The word of the Lord.
From my earliest memories, I grew up in El Paso, Texas. Light was a very big part of Christmas. In my family, it was really kind of over-the-top production. And one of the things I would do is string in the exterior of our home with my father Christmas lights, varying colors, and he was very precise. He drilled into me red, green, yellow, blue. Red, green, yellow, blue. I had to make sure I didn't get that out of order. We also, because I was on the Mexican border, we had luminarios. Are you familiar with those? So, you know, these are small brown paper bags with candles, and we'd line the house as well with those. So very big part. Obviously, it's a huge part of the holiday season in New York. And there is a connection, at least, to the ancient story in the Bible of Advent, which means coming of the Lord. And it goes much further back, actually, than the coming of Jesus. The Bible begins in darkness. It is a very deep, dark, chaotic place, the very first verses of the Bible, and the first words that God utters, let there be light. That's significant. And with those words came the advent of hope. And so there is an incredibly important connection in the Bible from the earliest points between the idea of darkness and light as it pertains to hope in the human experience. And that's what we want to explore this morning, is the idea of light in darkness and how it can breed hope in our own experience. We're looking at one of the more famous passages about Advent or Christmas in the Old Testament or Hebrew scriptures, written roughly 700 years before Jesus was born, and yet speaking a great deal about what the significance of his coming would be in the way of light coming into the darkness of the world and our own personal darkness and the hope that that might offer for people. So let's think about this together. How can we discover, how can we rediscover hope as we think about light in darkness? First of all, the distress of darkness. And then secondly, the liberty of light. Just those two things, the distress of darkness and the liberty of light from Isaiah chapter 9. Now, notice the very first words and all the reference to darkness that frame this passage. Nevertheless, I mean, simply nevertheless, what does that do? It should point us back. We should look over our shoulder at the passage that comes before. Chapter 8 is a gloomy place. In fact, it's a very dark, deep darkness in chapter 8 where the nation of Israel finds itself. And then he moves on. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom, so a sign of hope. For those who were in distress, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You see the gloom, you see the fear, you even sense the evil of darkness in this passage. I hope you do. Let's unpack that a little bit, the gloom of this darkness. It was an incredibly gloomy day historically. This was the day that the prophet Isaiah, who's writing this beautiful poetry, the first verse is prose, and then the rest of the passage is poetry. And he's living in the day of the ascendancy of the Assyrian Empire, who was flexing its muscle, and their first invasion, the final overthrow of Israel by the Assyrians, did not come until 722, but 11 years earlier, they invaded, they ransacked, they deported the best talent in Israel back to their homeland, and began to shift the axis of power in Israel from Israel to Assyria. That happened 11 years earlier with the invasion of the two lands that are mentioned here that are west and southwest of the Sea of Galilee. And with this, imagine the devastation. I mean, if you're living in Israel, if you're Isaiah, if you're watching what's happening, how incredibly devastating and disillusioning and gloomy this must have been. One of the things that first surprised us, our first winter in New York, was how early it gets dark here. I mean, you're like, 4:15, really? What's going on here? And some of us feel it, don't we? You feel that darkness. 'Tis the season, but we feel the holiday blues. And that is not unusual. Study after study shows, in terms of psychological studies, show that the season between Thanksgiving and New Year's, depression soars. People become frantic and oftentimes don't know where to go. And that's exactly what was happening in this day, in this season, that seemed at that point to be unending to them. It says that they were walking in darkness, living in the land of deep darkness. So walking is obviously a word picture for a lifestyle. This is our daily routine. We are walking in the midst of darkness. This is our life. And our homeland, our pride and our joy, we are to be this spotlight to the rest of the world. And now things are very bleak. I mean, the last flicker of hope, the pilot light has just gone out, seemingly, for Isaiah. Bertrand Russell said, "There is darkness without, and when I die, there will be darkness within. There is no splendor, no vastness anywhere, only triviality for a moment, and then nothing." Now, he could have just had a bad day. I mean, we've all been there, right? But that is the human experience. If you feel that way, that is not abnormal. But what this passage is saying is you don't have to remain there. You don't need to be stuck in that place. There is hope. There is the possibility that things will be different. And so I think this invites us to ask that question right now. Is there a gloom of darkness in our own experience? Is there a substantial loss in your life, relational, financial, otherwise? Have expectations just not been met? Is there something that seems unresolvable in your life and it just the gloom is setting in? It's getting dark very early. What do you do about that? And since the gloom of darkness, then the fear of darkness you also sense, because that the fear that comes with darkness, it's intuitive, right? I mean, it exacerbates the gloom because a panic starts to set in. You start to hear things and imagine things in the darkness in your own dark place. Years ago, remember the movie Silence of the Lambs? Ellen and I didn't see it when it came out in the theaters. So this was back in the day when you rented videos, you know, and so we rented this and we're watching it in our bed and we get to the end and the credits are running. It wasn't just Silence of the Lambs, it was silence in our room. And I reach for the light, and Ellen reaches over and blocks my hand and says, "Don't you dare turn out the light." There was an eeriness. There was an evil there that began to create an increased level of gloom and fear. And that's extremely normal as well for us, I think, you know, as we deal with different things in our life, because what happens is the fear that accompanies darkness can easily dominate our experience, our subconscious level. The world within us, not just the world out there, becomes dark. So it's both the world out there and the world in here where you sense the gloom, the fear, and the evil of darkness. I mean, Isaiah was not exempt from this. You'd think, well, here's an all-star person, very powerful. He must have lived a charmed life. No, he suffered considerably. Tradition has it that his life ended by being sawn in two by the evil king Manasseh. Now, that's a bad day, okay? So he understood deep, penetrating darkness. But you'd be misreading this passage if you just projected and saw it as talking about the evil that's out there, because it's really talking about the evil inside of us. And this is what you, if you backtracked and read chapter 8, for instance, you'd sense that really what's going on here is that the people of God are wandering away from their God. They're looking for, they're self-medicating in all sorts of places. So they're going off to mediums and sorcerers, and they're looking for comfort in the midst of their darkness. And that only begins to make things worse for them. That's the same experience that each of us have as well. The more that we run off to other things to try and self-medicate, to rely on other things to help lift us temporarily, even out of the darkness, it begins to poison our experience, wherever it might be. And I mean, you can see it, for instance, if you've had a relational break, if someone has really injured you, it's so easy to become cynical and bitter and want the worst of them. I was really saddened this week at the death of Nelson Mandela. What an extraordinary individual. One of the quotes that I saw, I was scrolling through a bunch of his quotes, and one of the quotes, certainly a man who dealt with deep darkness and the enslaving power of that darkness, literally, as he was left in prison for so long. He said this: "Resentment is like drinking poison and then hoping it will kill your enemies." That is so true. But it's one of these reflexes inside of us to cope with that kind of relational injury. Look, the world can be a very dark place. We can be very dark places. Christianity, Christmas, does not come along and sentimentalize these things. It doesn't paste on a "be happy" on top of all of the pain and sadness in a person's life. But neither is it fatalistic, all right? So it's not Pollyanna, but it's not fatalistic either. It's realistic. It's encouraging us to adopt an alternative reality in the midst of whatever dark place where you may find yourself. It embraces that alternative reality. In Christmas, Advent, it says, yes, things are as dark as they may appear to be oftentimes. But God enters into that darkness just like he did on the very first page of the Bible and says, "Let there be light." So that's, first of all, the distress of darkness, the gloom of it, the fear of it, the way in which it absolutely captures our attention and even produces evil inside of each one of us. But now let's look to the liberty of light, because that's exactly what God's introduction of light has done throughout time. How is it liberating, first of all? Well, Isaiah uses language here, kind of in the middle section of this passage. I'm looking specifically at verse 4, where it's a little confusing literarily, but remember, it's poetry. So you can throw a lot of things in there, and they're designed for you to unpack them. We don't have time to go into detail about Midian, other than to say that it was a time where God intentionally withdrew his armed forces and essentially brought about this extraordinary victory over the Midianites through Gideon to say, this is not something you're going to accomplish. This is something I'm going to accomplish. And the very last words of this passage reinforce that. The zeal of the Lord Almighty, the Lord of the armies of Israel, the Lord of hosts, will bring this about. But embedded in there with this idea of Midian is language that's actually hearkening back to the experience that Israel had many years earlier in Egypt. Remember, they went to Egypt because they were starving to death. But then hundreds of years passed, and they found themselves enslaved under a vicious despot and warlord, Pharaoh. And so you see some of that enslaving language there in verse 4. The yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, and the rod of their oppressors. In Egypt, their lives fell apart. And he's saying, you know, way down the road now, he's saying to them in Isaiah 9, your lives have fallen apart. And part of it is your own doing. And you are enslaved to your own darkness. But you don't need to be stuck there. Because there is a kind of freedom or liberty that comes through the advent of light. It overcomes the darkness. It reverses those things. It lets us go free from the gloom, the fear, the evil of darkness. And it brings, what he says in verse 3, a deep happiness. Happiness really doesn't even bring the right color to this word, the English word happiness. Verse 3, it increased their joy. They rejoice before you. It's this otherworldly ability to be able to see things, to bring this alternative reality to intersect into the reality of your circumstances, and you begin to see light, and that brings hope, and it brings the advent of joy. Now, how do you get that? Well, verses 6 and 7 highlight this, some of the more well-known words in the prophet Isaiah. How do you get this? This amazing transforming light that's going to change you. It's going to change the whole world one day. It comes in the smallest of places. What a beautiful picture. It comes in a child. For unto us a child is given. Now, this obviously was no ordinary child. He is given a number of names, and you don't have to, I don't think we're supposed to see this as exhaustive. It's in the ancient world, of course, names spoke about the character of the person. It was their resume. And so each of these names, there's an entire world of wonder. It begins with Wonderful Counselor. But there's a sense in which that word wonder should inform every one of these attributes of who the Messiah would be. He's, by being a wonder of a counselor, he is matchless in beauty and awe, that if we really begin to grasp who he is, it will experientially cause us to absolutely be breathtaking by who he is. And so he is a wonder of a counselor. A counselor is someone who knows you really well. Someone who, I mean, if you've been to a really effective therapist or counselor, you know, it's like, oh my goodness, how did they get there? I thought I was all packaged up tight and neat. And a good therapist or counselor, you know, in the Star Trek words, they can go where no one has gone before. And that's exactly what God does. He enters into these dark places, maybe even some dark spaces in your life that you didn't even know were there. And he's able to speak words of wisdom, this counselor is, to help us understand ourselves and make sense of those darker places in our life. And mighty God, this is speaking of God who is the champion. He is the fierce warrior God. He takes on all of our enemies and defeats them just like that. There's nothing that can stand. And so with that kind of power behind us, regardless of how frail you may feel, you've got the Lord God Almighty behind you. And That is emboldening. It gives a certain fortification and courage to us. And yet, it's astounding that this magnificent sovereign is going to be born into the world. The contrast, you sense that? It's just really remarkable. How could God be born? But that's the prophecy. Everlasting Father, this mighty being will not relate to his subjects simply as subjects, but as family, as the ideal, the ultimate, the Father that all of us long to have. He is that everlasting Father who will pour out his love upon us. And again, how astonishing that God can be human. He can be born, that he can be fearsome and holy and yet loving and tender. These things don't seem to intermix in our ordinary experience, but they do in this one wonder of a being. Ann Voskamp said this: "He who carved the edges of cosmos curved himself into a fetal ball in the dark, tethered himself to the uterine wall of a virgin, and lets his cells divide, light splitting all white. He gave up the heavens that were not even large enough to contain him and lets himself be held. This mystery so large becomes the baby so small, and infinite God becomes infant." She begins to unpack or unwrap the wonder of this gift. And Prince of Peace, we've already heard that he's a king, so why is he called Prince of Peace? In the ancient world, they had slightly different functions, usually. The king was more the one, he's more like the CEO, who would, here is the vision, and then the prince is more like the COO. He's the executor, he's the administrator, he's the one that's going to come along and make sure that everything is carried out down to the most minute detail. And he is the Prince of Peace. Now, that word, you may know, is a very big word in Hebrew. It doesn't just mean that hostilities are pushed aside, that people are reconciled. It means that, but it means so much more. It has the idea that the word shalom or peace, it means wholeness, completeness. That sense in your own life that things just aren't right, it means that he's come to put you back together. But not just us individually, he's come to put the entire world back together. And when he comes again, that's exactly what he will complete. It's a long-term project that he initiated in his first coming and will complete when he comes again. Now, how is he going to do that? Well, it is this upside-down picture of the good news of the Advent or Christmas message that you see all throughout the Bible. Just as this incredible power, this transforming light comes in the form of the smallest of individuals, a little baby, who frankly was, he wasn't born into a palace. There was no room for him, and he was born in the darkness of a cave in Bethlehem. And his life, in many ways, would be tragic, a man of sorrow and suffering, Isaiah would later say. And ultimately, he will, at the light of the world, he will allow himself to be consumed completely by darkness. Jesus allowed himself to be nailed to this world of dark space so that you and I might be released from it if we believe in him, if we trust in him. And I think it is interesting that when Jesus was hanging there on the cross, the light of the world, for several hours, everything went dark. It's because that reversal occurred as Jesus bled and died for us. Now, how do we know in our own experience that no dark moment means the end? It's because in the darkest of moments, Jesus' crucifixion, from it sprang the greatest light the world has ever known. And if that's true, argument from the greater to the lesser, if that's true in Jesus' experience, and it is, then of course it's true in ours. We never need to feel that sense of desperation where there is no way out. There is no light at the end of the tunnel. Because in Jesus, the light has come into our life. And we receive this as a gift. Just like the gift of Gideon's defeat over Midian was, it was all of grace. God saying, my zeal is going to accomplish this. You're not going to contribute anything. So our being rescued out of darkness into his light comes as a gift. Unto us is given. See, it's given to us as a gift. Jesus would later say in John chapter 12, I have come into the world as a light so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. So what do we have to do? Believe in him. And this isn't just speaking to people who wouldn't identify as a Christian, if you would not describe yourself as a Christian this morning, certainly this applies to you, that you move out of the darkness positionally into his light simply by trusting, by relying, by believing into him. But the word believe or faith in the Gospel of John, used some 98 times, is always an active, it's a verb. And it's an idea. It's not like, well, I prayed a prayer, I believed something back in the past. No, it's what now, in this moment, in this pocket of darkness, am I trusting and relying upon? It's the light of life if we do that. So why do we resist him? Well, there's a variety of reasons, of course, we resist him. I don't know. I think that it's easier to keep Jesus at something of an arm's length or even further, sort of like a star. It is interesting that a star marked the arrival of the light of the world. And, you know, you look at a star in the night sky. When we were back home over Thanksgiving to El Paso, I could actually see stars in the sky. It was pretty amazing. And, you know, I re-remembered this idea that stars are beautiful from a distance, but as soon as you get anywhere close to them, you're incinerated. You're consumed by them. And I think it's that way with Jesus. We often feel this sense of wanting to resist him and keep him at arm's distance because getting too close, he will consume you. But look, what the good news of the gospel is that Jesus allowed himself to be consumed by darkness so that we might be consumed by his light and enjoy the liberty of it. It's not an enslaving. It's just the opposite. As we come into his light, as we give ourselves to him, as we continue to discover that, we experience his light. So how do we discover and rediscover that? Just a few things in closing, in the way of taking this the next step. How do we rediscover or discover the hope of light as we walk through the life of darkness? Well, we have to live in the light. Jesus said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me," this is John 8, "will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Are you sensing, by the way, that light and darkness is a major theme in the Gospel of John? It is. How do you do this? How do we begin to practice this in our life? By following Jesus. He is the light of life. It's not a matter of doing new things, building new routines primarily. It's about following the one who is the light, and he will take us into his light. And we have to be intentional about that, right? I mean, again, this time of year in New York, the way the sun is positioned, it's oftentimes difficult. You can go a whole week and never really see direct sunlight, right? And so you have to work at it. And you know, you cross an avenue and you got that direct light and you just kind of want to stop and be transfixed for a moment. Get some vitamin D. Well, it's similar spiritually that we need to, in the dark days of spiritual winter, we need to be intentional about seeking out direct sunlight. And the way we do that is through the Bible, through the scriptures. Psalm 119 says, "Lord, your word is a light unto my path." So we go into his word and allow his word, which is light, to begin to show us the pathway amidst the darkness that we're walking in, and we begin to discover that hope. And you begin to claim, as it were, the promises of the Bible as present realities. Did you notice that, you know, Isaiah 9 is written as things are falling apart? They're really, circumstantially, there is no hope. But it's written in the past tense. All the verbs are in the past tense. Why? Because Isaiah is saying it is so sure, this hope is so certain, that we can forecast it as though it's already accomplished. And that is so instructive in terms of how we should be navigating the dark places of our own life, is finding places in the scripture that speak of God's light, his grace, his goodness, and tenaciously holding on to those, confident of his goodness, so that what ends up happening is you sense that the darkness is actually behind you experientially, even though it may not be. Let me give you an example of this. Beethoven said of George Friedrich Handel, "Handel was the greatest composer that ever lived. I would uncover my head and kneel before his tomb." It's pretty important claim to him. King George III called Handel the Shakespeare of music. But did you know that Handel struggled tremendously in his life. Critics were constantly taunting him over his own battle with his weight. Professionally, he vacillated between success and failure. He experienced bankruptcy twice and was stricken with apoplexy amid the ruin of his company. And the situation